and welcome to our new episode of podcast. I'm Deepa Adhikari. As you know, Freedom Forum is producing podcasts regularly on various issues such as press freedom, freedom of expression, RTI, media policies and laws, human rights and many more. In addition, podcast also covers the views of experts on different contemporary issues. A noted international scholar on right to information, freedom of expression and press, Mr. Toby Mendel is currently the executive director of the Center for Law and Democracy, a Canadian-based international human rights NGO providing expertise on law and capacity building on human rights for democracy. Earlier, he was also the senior director for law at Article 19. Mr. Mendel has wide range of experiences in the field of right to information and freedom of expression. He closely observes the global wave on these issues. He has provided ample suggestions and recommendations as experts to numerous governments and rights organizations, including the World Bank, UNESCO, and Council of Europe. Mr. Mendel has long attachment with Nepal. For nearly two decades, he has been observing Nepal's FOE issues, sharing his knowledge and expertise. His role for the media reform here is significant indeed. Many Nepali FOE practitioners are trained by him. In recent visit to Nepal, Freedom Forum took his views on the pressing issues relating to the Media Council Bill, Information Technology Bill, and Advertisement Bill. These bills have drawn criticism in Nepal, and even the government has put this under consideration following the criticisms. The views by the noted experts, Mr. Mendel, on these bills will be helpful suggestion to make laws on FOE in line with the democratic values. Freedom Forum hopes his views will give relevance to these issues in terms of international practices. Here is what Mr. Mendel had to say on these issues.
I'm going to do two primary things. Firstly, I'm going to talk a little bit about the guarantee of freedom of expression under international law. What it means, what it means in this and that and the other sector. Then, secondly, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about three bills that are before Parliament. Many of you are members of Parliament, so it's your job to consider these bills, to consider the bill is okay or need to be amended. According to me, all of the bill, they need some amendment. Of course, no bill is perfect, but some of them, they need quite a bit of amendment. And the three bills I will focus are the Information Technology Bill, the IT Bill, the Media Council Bill, and the Advertising Bill. So those three bills, I think you know very well, they are before Parliament right now, so I think it's a current time. And then I will finish with just a few small comments on the issue of the constitutional allocation of powers in relation to the media in Nepal. Because you have a new constitution, 2015 constitution. For the first time, you are really, you know, living that constitution. So I think it's important to consider about that. Okay, so under international law, Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the same article, Article 19 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, those are the ones that guarantee freedom of expression. And of course, Nepal is a party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the guarantee, not exactly the same, but very, very similar. I'm not going to quote the guarantee, but I will like to highlight some key elements of that. First, the guarantee protects the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas. It is not just the speaker. It is also the listener. If you think about the person as a citizen, the listening is more important than the speaking. You get all the information that you can use to make your decisions. When you vote, you're mostly a listener, and then you vote on the information you hear. And it's very important, and I'm going to talk about some of the implication of that. So not just speaking, but also listening. Secondly, it applies regardless of frontiers. The freedom of expression is not just inside of Nepal, but between Nepal and the rest of the world. With the modern internet, that's very, very important. Much of our communication are going globally. You know, we issued a press release this morning Normally, we issue our press release from Canada, where we're based. Today, we issued it right here in Kathmandu, and it went around the world. And I'm getting emails from around the world about our press release. So regardless of frontiers, is very important these days. It applies to any medium, whether you are speaking, whether you are writing, whether you are broadcasting, whether you are tweeting. Freedom of expression apply any way you are communicating. It apply to everyone. I am a foreigner here in Nepal, but I have the right to freedom of expression, just like you have the right to freedom of expression when, as I hope you will, you come and visit me in Canada. Then it applies to ideas of all kinds, not just the ideas we like, but especially the ideas we don't like. Those are the ones that need protection. If everybody agrees, then the idea doesn't need protection. It's when only one person supports the idea and everybody else disagrees, then the protection is the most important. Even things that some people find offensive. Oh, that's offensive to me. This is still protected by freedom of expression. Of course, up to some limit. And we'll talk about that in a minute. And then final point I will make is on the attributes, is that it imposes both positive and negative obligation on the state. The negative doesn't mean negative in the bad sense, but negative, it means that the state should not interfere, not being the negative part. So the state should leave the citizen, leave the member of parliament free to say what they want. That's called the negative aspect. State should not interfere. But it also put a positive obligation on the state. Sometimes the state need to take positive action to protect freedom of expression. And if we look at the combined characteristics of freedom of expression, really what it is it's the free flow of information and ideas in society. We want to maximize the flow of information and ideas. So, for example, in Nepal, you have Right to Information Act. We have the Chief Information Commissioner here with us representing the Right to Information Act. It's a positive obligation on the state to have the right to information and to give the information to citizens. If all of the information held by government, only available to government, the free flow of information and ideas is not strong. All of that information is locked. So it needs to go out and be available to everyone. Of course, with exceptions. So there are positive and negative obligations. Okay. Now, we all know that freedom of expression is not absolute. There are some things that you cannot say, some things you cannot communicate. Everybody accept and recognize that. And international law have a very clear and precise test about the restrictions. And it's a three-part test. And the way international law works is it doesn't directly impose the restriction. It allow the state to impose the restriction. With some small exception. Basically, international law protect freedom of expression, protect everything, and then allow the state under condition to restrict it. And there are three conditions, and they are like this. Firstly, the restriction must be provided by law. Okay, that means that parliament have to pass the law with the restriction. It is not for the minister or the prime minister or anyone acting by themselves. It's for parliament to impose the restriction. And the law, furthermore, under this part of the test, the first part, the law needs to be clear and narrow. Not flexible law. Flexible law is not the law. It needs to be precise. It needs to say exactly what is not allowed to be said. You cannot say child pornography. We know what child pornography is. That's clear and precise. But you cannot restrict things that we don't like. Okay, that's not clear and precise. And it's not, you know, not a clear meaning. So the law needs to be clear and precise. Second part of the test is that the law must protect one of a list of legitimate interests. These are the interests that under international law are considered important enough to restrict freedom of expression. And they are, and this is the full list, the rights and reputations of others, national security, public order, public health, and public morals. So to protect public health, to protect national security, we can restrict freedom of expression. But, for example, to protect the economy is not in this list. We cannot restrict freedom of expression just to protect the economy. That's not big enough interest. Okay? Only these lists. Then the third part of the test is that the restriction must be necessary. And I'm going to break that down into different parts because this is most complicated part of the test. Firstly, the restriction should not be overboard. If you want to stop child pornography, you have to stop only child pornography and not all of other things. If you want to protect national security, you focus only on national security and not on other things beyond that. The restriction must cut only the harmful speech, not other speech that's not harmful. Secondly, the way you do that must be the least restrictive way that you can use to protect the interest. Often, there are different ways to protect, let's say, national security or public order. For example, you can protect public order by banning demonstrations. We won't have any demonstration, then we don't have a problem with public order. That's not the least restrictive way. The least restrictive way is to allow the demonstration and to provide police around the demonstration so that it can be peaceful and not threaten public order. So when you have a choice of different way, you must choose the least restrictive way. And then finally, the restriction must be proportionate. That's to say the balance between the restriction and the benefit from the restriction and the harm to freedom of expression must be balanced. We are not going to completely close freedom of expression only for small benefit. There need to be a balance. And importantly, that also applies to the sanctions. If the sanction is too heavy, that is a breach of the proportionality principle. The sanction must also be proportionate. For a small harmful statement, we have a small sanction. For a massive harmful statement, we can have a bigger sanction. That's the proportionality. Okay. Now, I want to talk now about some of the key principles that flow from this guarantee for legacy media regulation. If we think about the traditional media, newspapers, radio, television. Everybody's talking about the digital media and the new media and the blah, blah, blah. It's very, very important. But in Nepal, legacy media is still very important. So we still need to think about how we regulate that. First principle here is that regulatory bodies, those bodies which exercise power over the media or over freedom of expression, they need to be independent of government. We cannot have government controlling the media. We may need to regulate the media. The media is powerful and we need to regulate. But we cannot have government do it. It needs to be by an independent body. It's a very, very clear principle under international law. Every time you have a case with a non-independent body, courts are clear, not legitimate. And I'm not going to get into details about how to guarantee the independence. It's a bit complicated, but there are ways, and we can talk about it later if you want. There should be an independent governing board. You know, for the media council that you have a bill, the board needs to be independent. The way you appoint the members, the funding, the powers, these are all, you know, issues about independence. Secondly, a key goal of media regulation needs to be to promote diversity. In other words, we don't regulate to control the media, we regulate to have more media. I said before that the right to freedom of expression protects the listener as well as the speaker. The listener does not want to hear only one media outlet. The listener wants to hear many different perspectives and then choose which one they like, choose which perspective they agree. So for the listener, we need to have diversity. As many different types of media voices as possible, given the society, given the size, given the wealth. So in Nepal, you have quite strong diversity. You have a lot of broadcaster. You have different type of broadcaster. So diversity and there are many different ways to get diversity. For example, you should have three different type of broadcasters: community, commercial, and public service. And more or less in Nepal, you have that. Public service, not quite public service, but more or less. You need to control concentration of ownership. We can't have one person own all the media. Then we only hear that person. And there are ways like that. And one of the important issues about diversity is whether we will license or register the media or whether we just allow it to go free. Now, in broadcasting, if we just allow anyone to start any broadcaster, we will have chaos immediately. Chaos in the airwaves, because still the broadcaster is using the airwaves. There's a limited number of airwaves. And if everyone just grabs what they want, there will be conflict and chaos. In the United States, in the early days, it was free to start the radio. And everybody was starting the radio, and very, very quickly, the interference with the frequencies and this problem came up. And they realized, okay, we need to regulate this. So for broadcasting, licensing will create more diversity, because licensing will ensure that everybody have the frequency right next to each other, and that, you know, the development can be in the way to create more diversity. For print media, this problem is not the same. And for print media, under international law, licensing is not legitimate. Even registration is generally considered unnecessary. You don't need to register. They can register as a company. All newspapers are companies. So this is a kind of registration. It's enough like that. So the question of licensing and registration is also linked to the idea of diversity. A third principle is that we should not have media-specific content rules. We have a law on defamation. You know, you can't say lies that harm another person. Okay, that's a principle everywhere in the world, also here in Nepal. That applied to the media, for sure, but we don't have a special defamation law for the media, because it's the same thing if the media or if a private person. Maybe the impact can be more in the media. If a big media tell a lie about me, everybody hear it, my reputation suffer a lot. If one person say to his friend a lie about me, my reputation only suffer a little bit. That's about the damages, but not about the rule. But that statement and the media statement, it's the same. Hate speech, statements against national security, they are not different in the media and any other way of expressing yourself. So there should not be media-specific rules. The exception to that is the idea of complaints, professional complaint systems against the media. So the Media Council bill that you are considering puts in place something system like that. It's accepted around the world that because of the power of the media, it's appropriate to put in place an administrative, not a civil, not certainly not a criminal, but an administrative system of complaints, so that individuals who have been harmed or whose privacy has been invaded or whatever the thing that has happened can complain and get some redress. But these systems need to respect a few principles. Firstly, like every regulatory system, the body that oversees it must be independent. Nothing can be done unless independent body. Secondly, the sanctions that are applied by this body must be the light sanctions. If we're going to have damages through this system, then it's a parallel to the civil law. So it's not an administrative system anymore. It's a pretending to be administrative, but it's really a civil law system if you provide for compensation. I think some of you will know that in your Media Council bill, you have a compensation rule, and I would say that is not legitimate because you have the civil law or the criminal law for compensation. We don't put that in administrative system. The goal of the system should be to promote professionalism, not to punish. The criminal law is to punish. You steal, we slap you. You do a wrong like that from criminal thing, and we slap you. Naughty boy. We put you in prison. But this is not the purpose of this system. The purpose of this system is to uplift the professional standard of the media. It's a very different purpose, and this is why the sanction should not be the heavy sanction. If you want to slap the wrist, you go to the civil or the criminal, not this administrative system. And of course, the process before this body have to be fair. Okay, I want to move on now and talk a little bit about that was old, you know, in the old world, pre-digital, let's say. But now, of course, we live in a digital world. Everything is digital. every one of you have a digital device. I'm looking at another digital device here. Every single person have some digital device, many digital device. Okay, so we're communicating in a totally different way. And this have introduced a lot of changes to international standards about regulating speech and regulating communications, but less changes than people often assume. Okay, before we used to regulate the media, we have a media council, we're going to use the media council to hear about complaints and impose the professional standards. Before, we knew what a media was. It was a newspaper or radio or a TV, you know, that was it. I mean, before like 30 years, yeah. Now, of course, it's very, very different. It's not so clear what is a media today. And I want to say something, it's a little bit strong thing to say, but I believe it's absolutely correct. Social media is not media, okay? These guys grabbed that name, they call themselves social media, it's a very nice name, but it's not media. I mean, how many people are on Facebook? Everybody, I think. Everybody, yeah? When you go on Facebook and you put your messages, you communicate, are you a journalist? Do you become a journalist? Anyone become a journalist just because on Facebook? No, it's not media. And this have caused just this word, this name, social media, it have caused enormous amount of confusion. I think most of the young people in the world honestly don't have any idea what is media or what is not media. They think they go on Facebook, they chat to their friends, you know, maybe they read some news feed. Okay, that's maybe like a little bit media, and they think they're in the media world. They've never read a newspaper, they've never watched the news even on TV, and they don't know any idea what media is, but they think it's media because it's called social media. So this has caused a lot of confusion. So the issue become, if you're trying to regulate the media, which can be appropriate, we're going to license broadcasters, we may have a complaint system, these are the issues that you are considering, what are we going to call the media? Okay, so to start with, we still have the legacy media, the newspaper, the radio, the TV. Okay, we know what they are. That's easy. Then, all of those legacy media, traditional media, they have online version. Okay, we're going to cover that because that's still media operation. So we're going to include that within the definition of media. The newspaper have the printed version and the online version is all fine. So far, that's easy. But what about the thing that does not print, does not broadcast, is just online and nothing else? How do we know if that's a media or not? Okay, this is the biggest challenge. And I will point to two systems globally that I think are better practice in this area. And I can tell you, you know, you can find laws all over the place. And most of the time, and I'm sorry to say this, but it's also the case with your Media Council bill, you include the definitions which are absolutely unclear. Under your definition, in your Media Council bill, my tweet makes me a media. Makes me a journalist and makes me a media. That's not the right way to do things. In that case, everybody in the poll is a journalist. Everybody is running a media outlet. And the concept of media has no meaning. So I think that many of the laws that you find around the world, they take this kind of approach. It is going to be completely unworkable for you. I had a meeting about 5 months ago with the press council in Myanmar. So Myanmar is trying to become a democracy. They established independent press council, very independent, that they want to do the right thing. And they said to me, you know, what is the media? So I said, well, you know, what about your law? And they said, yeah, but our law doesn't tell us what a media is. It defines media. It includes definition of the, but it doesn't tell us what a media is because the definition is not effective. So this is a big problem. And if you look around the world, you're going to find a lot of confusion about this. And I think there are two sensible possible solutions. The first is the approach taken within the Council of Europe. Look at whether the entity has an editorial process. Is this a single person, like a blogger, posting news and information? It is news, but it's not a media. Is it a single person doing that, or is there an editorial process? Does somebody submit, you know, the content, and then an editor oversee the thing? That we have in a newspaper, that we have in a radio, that we have in a broadcaster. If we have it in the online, then it can be treated as a media. And we have a lot of those things online. Some very important newspaper or newspaper broadcaster, I don't know what exactly, but some very important news sources are only online. But they have an editorial process, they have journalists reporting and editors who plan the thing, and they have a definition of what an editorial process is in the European documents. So that's their approach. If there's an editorial process, it's a media. If there's no editorial process, it's not. Fine, that's one approach. Another approach, which I actually prefer more, and I'm going to call it the Indonesian approach, because Indonesia has taken this approach. In Indonesia, they say, okay, the legacy media are covered, and the online version of the editorial media are also covered. After that, we are going to do it on a voluntary basis. If you want to be considered like media, you accept the system and then you become bound by the system. And at that point, you have to obey the code of conduct. You can be sanctioned if you breach the code of conduct. You are subject, like all of the media, to the system, voluntary. That may sound a little bit funny, like who will volunteer? But in Indonesia, if you're the media, you also get some protections. For example, you can protect your sources. You have a confidential source, you can protect if you're a media. That's a benefit. You can put on your website, we are recognized media. You know, it's like ISO standard. You know, we're a media, not just blogger, not just blah, 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 but actual media content. And they also have some other important benefits in Indonesia. So I think so these are two systems which I will suggest to you for your consideration. Okay. Another issue in the digital era is, what about the liability for the intermediary? So we have Facebook and Snapchat and Google and whatever, all of these people, and your internet service provider, Uridon, and I don't know, who are the telecoms here?
We have lots of them.
Internet service providers. So what is the liability of these people for the content that they are helping to spread? Because if you want to defame somebody, you need access to the internet if you're going to put it online. So the internet service provider is helping your defamatory statement, your child pornography, your whatever, you know, travel. So what about their liability? When do they become liable? And under international law, it depends on the role they play. If the role is purely technical, so the ISP just give you a connection. Here's a pipe, use it to transmit. That's a purely technical function. Those people are not liable at all. They're never liable for the content. Of course, if a court says this is child pornography, they have to take it down. After the court order them, get rid of this thing, they have to take it down. If they don't take it down, they could be liable for that. But they're not directly liable ever for the content. Now, when we come to players like Facebook, that's more than a technical function. They're creating a whole platform, right? You know, they have a lot of services, if you will, functions that you use that help you communicate. They arrange your communication. They facilitate. They're not just connecting you. They're doing much more than that. What about their liability? So, again, under international law, if their engagement with you as the user is purely automated, so they have programs but they don't touch anything, then they are also not liable. And if you think about Facebook have 2.5 billion users, probably more now. I don't know how many billion, you know, posts a day, billions of them. Facebook's a big company, they have a lot of money, but they can't monitor or control all of that. They can't possibly be liable for it. So they're not liable. If, on the other hand, you moderate the content, you touch the content, you affect the content, then you are going to start to become more liable. So, for example, if you're a newspaper and you run a user-generated content section, you say, you know, post your comments, and the newspaper takes down certain comments, okay, because it doesn't like them, then it's going to be liable for the other comments. Because by intervening, it becomes responsible for the content. So it's about what kind of relationship you have. And I just want to say that when it comes to the issue of, I said if a court orders, you know, Facebook to take down child pornography, or the ISP to take down child pornography, going back to the principle I mentioned before, only independent bodies can moderate content, can affect freedom of expression. So we cannot have a government body ordering somebody to take down content. Just like we can't have a government body controlling the media or regulating the media, so we cannot have a government body controlling content on the digital either. And again, if you look to some of the legislation that you are considering, you have the department inside the ministry ordering to take down the bad content. That's not appropriate under international law, and I believe also under your own constitution. You need to have an independent body. You could set up an independent regulator, like the Information Commission is the independent regulator for information. You can set up the Independent Media Council. You can set up an independent, you know, online council that could order the takedown of illegal content, but not by a government department. Third issue, encryption and anonymity. Under international law, it's clear that people have a right to use encryption tools and to be anonymous. They have that right. Furthermore, in practical reality terms, even though, again, your legislation try to control that, you don't have to be very clever to be anonymous as you want and encrypted as you want online. Some of the services, they have end-to-end encryption, like Gmail has introduced end-to-end encryption. They even themselves, Google itself, cannot go inside of that encryption. It doesn't control that. It's an automated encryption thing that it don't, I mean, I don't know how it works. I'm not an engineer. But it's encrypted against Google. It's certainly encrypted against the government of Nepal and the police and the security people and all that kind of stuff. So, and I'm saying, I'm stressing a little bit on this again, because again, in the draft legislation, you have some attempt to control about encryption. I think that as a practical level, you can't enforce that. You can't do that. You know, even the Chinese, with their superpower, you know, in terms of digital whatever, cannot control even the somewhat sophisticated citizen. Of course, the basic one, they can control it. Okay. Fourth, what about the scope of the regulation? So you're here in Nepal and you want to regulate the things that are taking place in Nepal. Okay, that's fine. But, and this is again going to sound a little bit harsh, you have no power over Facebook. You have no power, Twitter. You have no power over Snapchat, okay? I'm sorry, but you don't. You cannot touch them. You have no jurisdiction over them. They have no presence here. You can't. The only thing you can do is to block them completely. That you can do. You can ban Facebook from operating in Nepal. Even that could be difficult, but I guess you could do that. But that's it. You can turn it on or off, but you can't set standards for Facebook. The content on Facebook, you know, you may think that it's pornography. Well, okay, Facebook doesn't allow pornography, but, you know, one other service, you may think that it's pornography and want to control it. You can. I mean, that's it. You can control the individual that's in Nepal's territory. So if I sign up as a Nepali to Facebook and I sign up as who I am and you can find me, you can try to control me for my use on Facebook, one by one like that. Although, even there, it's very, very easy to sign up as another name. So I'm on Facebook as Toby Mendel, so you can't go on as Toby Mendel, but you can go on as Toby Mendel, M-E-N-D-E-L-L. my name only have one L, and you can put one more L, and you're there as Toby Mendel. Any one of you can do that. Please don't. But so, you know, you can put, you know, the age for Facebook, you're supposed to be 13 before you join. And, you know, all of the kids, my kids' friends at school, they all join when they're 9 or 10. And they just put the different age. So, you know, it's very, very difficult for you to try to control that. So when you are setting rules in your law for social media and you put in place regime inside Nepal that's quite restrictive, you need to register, you need to get a license, you need a new license every year, blah, 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 like this. The impact of that will be that the international social media, Facebook, Snapchat, blah, 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 will all flourish and everyone in Nepal will use them. And there will never be a social media company in Nepal because nobody will go through that problem. They will register in India or in somewhere else where they don't have that problem. When you, in the globalized environment, when you try to set control inside the country, you just drive the business outside the country. And you cannot control at all what goes on outside. And it don't matter about language, okay? On Facebook, there's a whole bit of Facebook that takes place in Nepali language. And it's absolutely outside of your control. So, and anyone, any Nepali citizen can set up social media, stick it in Canada. It's completely about Nepal. It's 100% in Nepali language and you cannot control it. So you need to think very, very carefully what you really achieve by trying to control these things. The most what you achieve, you push them away. This is what I believe. Okay, so coming to the question of crimes, so digital crimes. So in general, before I said there should not be special content crime for the media. So the same thing, not special crime for online. Theft is theft, and I steal offline or I steal online, it's still theft. So I don't have a separate set of rules for the theft online. Definitely, I don't have a harsher set of rules for the online. The rule that you have for theft that you had for 100 years in Nepal, it's good enough for you. It's good enough for online too. For hate speech, for blah, 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 blah. Everything that is the same, essentially the same online and offline, you should not create new crime for the online. The only time you might think about that, if the offline crime doesn't capture the online because technical reason or something, in which case you just take the offline one, you amend the penal code so that it captures the online as well. That's what you do. You don't create a new crime because we have been working with these crimes. If you think about theft, okay, it has been developed by the courts in your law. It's now a sophisticated regime for dealing with theft. You don't want to create a new one in a you know, just applying to the online world that will not have that kind of sophistication. So, and especially with content issues. So we think about, you know, you have a bunch of content restrictions in Nepal. You know, you're restricting child pornography and other pornography. You restrict defamation. You restrict hate speech. You restrict privacy invasions. You have a bunch of content restrictions. Those apply online as well. So if you defame, if you hate speech, if you pornography online, it's the same crime. But you should absolutely not create a new offense for the online version, or you will end up with parallel crimes with different standards, and normally speaking, the online one will be less developed and less appropriate. Now, that doesn't mean that there are no digital crimes. There are few cases of digital crime. In some cases, there's behavior is entirely new online that doesn't have any kind of equivalent offline. For example, hacking. Okay, hacking is somebody going into your computer from outside and doing something that they're not authorized to do. It's a little bit like trespass. Okay, somebody go onto your property that shouldn't be there. But it's very different. Sorry. It's very different from the physical trespass because they're only going electronically. So you need a new rule for that. Spamming is another example, you know, where they try to take your system down by hitting you with all kind of rubbish. Now, in addition to that, there are a small number of issues which, even though they're formally the same online and offline, because of the way they happen online, their character changes. And I think a really good example of this is bullying. So, bullying is thousands of years old. 1,000 years ago, people were bullying other people. And in most countries, this was never a crime. Okay? When I was a kid, you know, there was a lot of bullying. It was a bad thing, but it was not a crime. It was not anything like that. Now, today, the bullying, because of the digital, become much, much more serious. For example, when I was a kid, you know, you go to school and you could be bullied, but then you come home and you're safe. You go in your house, you close the door, and the bully cannot come there. You know, you go, you get bullied, there's two or three people, they can be bullying you, but you can see them. You know, it's in front of your face, it's limited in scope. It wasn't nice, but it's somehow limited. With the digital, the scale changed completely. The bullying comes through your phone, it's part of your device. It's 24 hours a day, it follow you everywhere, and the scale of it can be much, much... The scale can be much, much greater. Instead of two or three people, it can be hundreds or even thousands of people. So, because of that, and we had a very, very high profile case in my province. Okay, I live in a small province. I know I'm competing with the food, but please try to still pay attention. We had a very high profile case where, okay, people,
it's okay.
Take the food, but you don't have to talk about it. I know it's very interesting than me, but. And we had this person, and she committed suicide because of the bullying. So our government then thought, okay, we need to do something about this. This is, you know, really bad thing. And they passed a very bad law, an anti-bullying law, cyber-bullying law. And the first case that went to the court struck it down. And it said the case is not constitutional, the definition of bullying, blah, 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 blah. And what we ended up with is an intimate images law. So if you share intimate images about someone else, like a boyfriend, girlfriend picture, and you share it without the consent, that now the law focuses on that. Because if you look at bullying in the modern, usually that's one of the more serious parts of it. You know, they attack you with this kind of intimate images problem. Anyway, so the point about all of this is that there are a few crimes which are new crimes because the nature changes in the online world. But you have to be very, very careful with that. It's easy to think, oh, we've got to deal with this problem. It's not easy to design well-balanced restriction on freedom of expression that will meet the constitutional standard. And my final point about crimes is that the online one, it's particularly important to have a very clear intent requirement. Because, for example, you know, you're on the computer and you can by mistake go into somebody else's computer that you didn't mean to, but it just, you know, things happen online. You know, with trespass, you're not going to walk onto somebody's property by mistake. You do it intentionally, but with, you know, online, it can happen like that. So you need to have the very clear intent requirements. And again, looking at your information technology law, some of the crimes, they don't have any intent at all. So this is really problematical. And some of them, the intent is, you know, too general, malintent. What's malintent? I mean, you need something clear and specific. Intent to defraud. Okay, that's a clear intent. Malintent, you know, you want to insult the person, is that a malintent? You know, so it's not clear enough. Okay, now I'm going to talk about some of the specific issues with your laws. I already got into that, so firstly, looking at the IT law, as I just said, several of the crimes that it establishes don't have any intent, or their intent is too weak. You need to have clear and specific intent. I really encourage those of you who are MPs to go through every single crime and say, what is the intent? Is it enough? Can we get a more specific intent? Secondly, many of the crimes are way too broad, or they're absolutely undefined. For example, you know, in one point it refers to a malicious program. What is a malicious program? You know, is it a program that I don't like? Is it a program that caused me harm? Is it, you know, it's not clear, and there's no definition in the law for that. You cannot establish a crime with something that ordinary person cannot tell you what it is. Okay? If I ask you what is a malicious program, you're going to give me one answer. If I ask him, he's going to give me another answer. This is not the way to have a crime. Then, as I mentioned before, we should not duplicate the crime from the offline to the online. There's no need for that. You have a theft law in Nepal. I guess it works okay. If you want to amend the theft law, by all means, go ahead and amend it. You have another theft in the... What for? There's no benefit to that. It's absolutely... It creates parallel, sometimes different, sometimes inconsistent regime about theft. You need one law on theft in Nepal to apply to everything. So, there are so many cases of duplication. Stealing, pornography, hate speech, you know, it go on and on and on.
Defamation, privacy,
so on. I mean, there's a long list of things. You have laws for all of that. Just live with the law you already have. Then you have a whole regime for data protection. Even starting with the definition. The definition of personal data is not correct at all. Okay, I'm sorry to say it. I know that sounds a little bit critical, but the definition, personal data, as recognized internationally, is information which personally identifies you. My name and something else. My telephone number, my medical record, my address, my anything like that. Anything that you can connect to me with another piece of information, that's personal data. Okay? And we have rules about personal data. Your law defined it in a completely different way. Medical records, of course, medical records are personal data, but you're defining it by example rather than by concept. Then you don't put in place the protection that's needed from a data protection regime. I'm not saying that you need to copy the data protection law from Canada, but our data protection law longer than your IT law. Okay? And, you know, the data protection, the complex issue, Nepal needs a data protection law. Go and write one, but do it properly. This, what you have in this law, just take it out and do the thing properly later on. Not effective. Thirdly, the investigative powers that you give to some of these bodies, they are massive and extensive. You give the controller the power to look at any computer at all. No, not the computer that had a reasonable necessity to look at for the crime, any computer at all. The regime of investigation, and again, you know, you have already in your law very, very detailed and clear and added onto by court decision rules about what the police can do, when they can investigate, what their powers to investigate. It's enough to go with that. You don't need another regime about that. That's just, frankly, crude. Okay, and the penalties. I mentioned before that penalties need to be proportionate. The penalties in the IT law, I mean, most of them have 3 or 5 or whatever years of imprisonment, the fines and whatever. I don't think the careful thought has been given to what this crime consists and what that penalty needs to be. The penalties, in my opinion, need to come down. And then the final and main problem with it is that in the attempt to regulate, what I can see is unreasonable control over so many aspects of the digital life, which in the end, okay, if Nepal is going to succeed economically, it needs to succeed digitally as well. I don't think any country in the world is going to have its economy grow without a strong digital element to that. It's absolutely central to life. If you put all of these control on the digital space, that growth will not happen. Your smart digital people will say, okay, this is too much trouble. I'm going to India. I'm going to Canada. I'm going somewhere where I can do my job freely. I can make money. I can run my business without this control. And just to give you some examples, and not just about business. So according to your law, the public services are only allowed to provide online services through a central portal and after putting a notice in the Gazette. In Canada, everything I do with government is online. Every interaction with my school, with my tax authorities, with my... They don't at all work through one portal. Every school has its own website. And I interact with the website. I want to see which days my son go to school. I go onto the school website. That's an online relationship. I want to see what his grades are. I want to see when his exams are. Blah, 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 blah. I go to the school website. A central portal for all of that. You know how many schools we have in Canada? It's not realistic at all. I don't know why the thinking behind this is just control-oriented. And to publish in the Gazette, so the school want to add a new service to interact with the students. They have to publish it in the Gazette. I'm sorry, but this is completely unrealistic idea. Yeah, then the restriction on domain name, it's in section or Article 59 of the IT law. All kind of controls on domain names, way beyond what's necessary. Equipment need to be certified as a type of equipment, and then you need to get permission to use that equipment. So I want to try a new device. I have got to get that device certified, and then I've got to get permission to use it. Can you imagine in this world of the IT development how Nepal is going to go with that? I'm sorry, but you know this completely, it will kill your digital growth. You can only store, public bodies can only store personal data in Nepal. So the first thing means that no public body can use Facebook anymore. Okay, Facebook doesn't in Nepal, right? The Facebook server is not in Nepal. It's somewhere. I don't know where it is. So all of the thing that you do on Facebook, you have to stop because that server, you're exchanging personal data. Okay, you're talking to a citizen. Their email, their message, their name is there. That's personal data. Okay, you can't do that anymore. And frankly, the idea that the server in Nepal is more secure than the Facebook server, for example, I'm sorry, but it's not realistic. Facebook have a very high... Even it get hacked sometimes, but I'm sure it's a more secure than the one in Nepal. This idea about data localization, I think it's a very unrealistic idea that don't have any benefits for you. Okay, and there are other control things like that. So I think that you really need to think, you know, what is the impact of this going to be? Now, the Media Council law is better than the IT law, but I still think it has some fairly serious problems. The first is that the council, I mentioned several times that the regulatory bodies need to be independent. The council, it is not independent enough. The staff is appointed by the minister. If we look at the members of the council, six of them are recommended by the minister, and one is an official from the ministry. Okay, that means the minister already controlled the council. Now, there's a very nice procedure for appointing the chairperson, but even that, the three members of the selection committee, all selected by the minister. So the minister controlled the selection committee, the minister controlled the chairperson. So everything somehow is under the control of the minister. Because of time, I'm not going to go into details about other options, but there are lots and lots and lots of ways to do this. I would start with involving more of civil society. Okay, and especially the media representative organs. This is a media council, so we need the media people to be involved with it. But this minister control body, not going to be effective. As I mentioned before, the definitions of what is a media, what is an electronic media, even what is a broadcaster, is not sufficiently clear. If you go back and you look at them and you think, okay, what could be included in this? And you will immediately start to think of all kind of things that could be covered or that are covered but that are not supposed to be. So those have to be completely revised. The sanction for the breach of the code, I mentioned before that the whole idea behind a complaint system is that the sanction should not be too high. Some of your sanctions are getting to the heavy side. For example, you can suspend a journalist. Under international law, no journalist should even have to be registered in the first place. So there's no way to suspend. In Canada, you can't suspend because the person isn't registered in the first place. Anyone who wants to write is a journalist. So how you can suspend that? Yeah. So, and that's the standard under international law. You can exclude the newspaper from the classification system, which will then affect their advertising. I think it's quite a heavy sanction for breach of the code. And then you get into the issue of fines and compensation. For me, this is absolutely outside of an administrative system. As soon as you start talking about compensation, you are talking about the civil law or possibly the criminal law. That's not the job of the council. That's the job of the... Okay. A number of smaller issues. I'm just raising some of the bigger issues. And then finally, the advertising law. And frankly, I'm going to say to you, you know, this law is the worst of the three, in my opinion. It's a very, very poorly thought through law. It's not even well written. The first point I will make is that advertisements are covered by the right to freedom of expression. Commercial speech is also speech, and it's very clear under international law. I said before, information and ideas of any kind, commercial, offensive, political, whatever, it's all covered. So commercial speech is not as highly protected as, for example, political speech because of the value of political speech in society, but commercial speech is still very important and it's very much protected, and you still have to apply the three-part test. And again, if you look at the definition, even starting with the definition of what is an advertisement in the law, is already problematical. Because the essential concept of an advertisement is you're trying to promote something. You're trying to promote the sale of a product. You're trying to promote an idea. You're trying to promote a political party. You're trying to promote a candidate. You're trying to promote something. And that idea is not even there. Without that, you know, and the whole law then revolve around this definition that's not even a correct definition. You have a whole set of rules on hoarding boards. Well, I mean, you know, maybe in Sweden, you know, this kind of rules could apply. But if I look down the street in Nepal and I see I don't mean to be rude, but, you know, kind of chaotic things and the wires everywhere and the traffic and the whatever, and the hoarding boards is going to be Swedish, but everything else is not going to be like that. So I think it's not realistic, you know. It's kind of idealistic, and some of the rules are really unrealistic. For example, you know, you have a rule that say that, you know, there are advertisement-free areas, like, temple and school and whatever. That's fine. But the part of that definition is that even from that place, you cannot see a hoarding board. Well, come on. I mean, you know, what if the school is on a hill? Then you look out from the school, you can see half of Kathmandu. I mean, it's not, you know, these are not realistic kinds of things. So you need to, you know, if you're passing a law, the rule has to be reasonable. And, you know, restricting free speech, it has to be very much reasonable. So you need to rethink about that again. The restriction on advertisements... of course, we can restrict advertisements, you know, dishonest advertisements, misleading advertisements, you know, whereas we could not restrict that for other speech, for advertisements, okay, but the restriction on advertisement in this case goes way beyond what is reasonable. Just to give an example, you basically prohibit the use of the flag in an advertisement. You know, I think the flag would be very insulted about being in the advertisement. I mean, you know, yes, be proud of your flag, but it doesn't mean that somebody can use it to advertise something. If what about, you know, the national Nepal Airlines or...
Do you have Nepal Airlines?
Yeah. You know, they want to use the flag to advertise their airline. What's wrong with that? It's a good thing. So these restrictions are unreasonable. When I mentioned about the council, and I said the council is not independent enough, at least you try to make it. But the advertising board, which have a lot of control over content, content of advertisements. It's absolutely not independent. Most of the members are officials. It's only officials on the advertising board. So it's automatically illegitimate body from perspective of international law. And furthermore, the advertising board can impose fines and compensation. Again, this is job of court, not of regulatory body, but certainly not of a politically controlled body. You imagine a government-controlled body imposing the compensation and fines. It's kind of taking over the role of the courts. There's a number of other smaller problems. In the end of that law, there's a bunch of rules which say that, the province, for the provincially licensed media, the provinces have to establish a committee to regulate and monitor the ads. And then the local level government, it have to establish a body to monitor and control the ads for the locally registered media. Now, I'm not a constitutional expert for Nepal constitution, but I have studied your constitution. And it have complicated relationship between law making and where there's kind of concurrent or overlapping jurisdiction. If the federal legislates, the other one have to legislate in line with them. That's my understanding. That is different. That's about legislation. That is different from the federal legislation telling the province what it have to do. I do not believe that the federal legislation can do. The federal legislation can go and do something using federal resources, using the money and the people from the federal government, but it cannot tell the province, you have to do this. It can set the standard in the law, and the provincial law have to follow that. But it cannot use the money given to the province and say, you have to do this and this and this. Otherwise, the province is not independent level of government. If the federal can tell them what to do, then they can control them completely. So I think that there's a major constitutional issue in that part of the law. And then finally, briefly, coming to the question of your constitutional arrangements about media. So I come from a federal country, Canada, and we have a long history. We were born, unlike you, we were born a federal country from the beginning. 1867, so we have 150 years of constitutionalism. And I can tell you, and this is true, that even though our constitution is pretty clear about the power for the province, we only have two levels, the power for the province and the power for the federal, for the first 100 years, most of the time in the Supreme Court was about fighting about those powers. Okay? Even though we have more clear than you, and only two levels and whatever. There was huge battles and huge arguments. Your constitution in the area of media, I think, is very, very unclear. And I believe that's true in other areas as well. And honestly speaking, I think you are going to have a big challenge to sort that out. I really think that, that because it's just unclear. And the basic rules is that the federal governments control the frequencies and telecommunications. Okay, that bit is clear. So anyone that wants to use a frequency, a radio in the local, television in the local or whatever, television in the province, they need to get a frequency from the federal power. And that has to be like that, because you need central control over the frequencies. In every country, those frequencies are controlled federally. Canada is a little bit bigger than Nepal, but we still control the frequency in the federal. United States, little bit bigger than Nepal, still control the frequency in the federal. That has to be like that. Okay, then, the federal regulate TV, but the province can operate. I don't honestly know exactly what that means. I think it means that if the province want to operate a TV, they can ask the federal for a frequency.
Yeah.
And if the federal give them a frequency, they can run a TV under the rule set by the federal. So the federal say for TV, TV have to do this, TV have to do that, and the provincial TV have to follow that rule. Now, what I find interesting is that the province regulate radio, not the federal. So the federal should not be regulating radio at all. And then the local can operate a radio. So the same relation as I see it. And then when it comes to newspapers and magazines, it's concurrent jurisdiction for all three of them.
Yes.
So I understand that to mean that they can, any of them, set rules and run newspaper and magazine, something like that. What I would say is, apart from the constitution, if we look at most countries, broadcasting, not just frequencies is regulated federally because it's the only logical way to do it. Otherwise, you have chaos. But broadcasting is regulated federally. In Canada, in South Africa, in United States, in all of these federal countries, the whole of broadcasting, radio, TV, all of it is regulated federally. Doesn't seem to be quite like that here. And the one exception that I know to that is Germany. And in Germany, broadcasting is regulated at the state level. But the reason behind that was that this system was put in place after the Second World War, and the feeling was that Hitler had used the federal control over broadcasting to control information, to confuse and brainwash the people, to persecute the war, to prosecute the war, and to perpetrate the Holocaust and kill Jews and gypsies and gay people and things, and that this horrible thing could only take place because Hitler could, sitting in the center, control the broadcast. So after that, they said, okay, we will not allow this again. We're going to divide the control over. So this is a very special reason for dividing like that. So in every other place, though, my final comment really is, I think that the federal government, many of you are federal legislators, I think that you should seek to regulate appropriately under international law, but to take in hand at the federal level the regulation of the media as far as you are, because I think it's better to have one set of rules as far as possible across the whole country for the media. I know, of course, that your idea of federalism is to have different federal entities, same in Canada, same everywhere else, but I think that it would be for the benefit of the development of the media if the rules are consistent across the country. I definitely, if you have different rules in each municipality for newspapers, I cannot imagine how that could possibly work. 753 sets of rules for newspapers, to me, is not realistic. So I think, with the Media Council law or bill, you are starting to do that, and I encourage you to do that. Okay, thank you for listening.
With this, we end our today's podcast. We also expect your critical and constructive comments on our podcast issues. Thank you for listening to us.